Hello everyone, Laurette Lynn, the Unplugged Mom here, bringing you more information, deliberation, thoughts, and pondering on the world of education, specifically education without the intrusion of school, which in my opinion, the two are mutually exclusive, education and school, because to really enjoy the benefit of learning and enjoy the benefit of a valuable education, we need to do that without the intrusion of school. So today, you're going to be listening to another fantastic conversation that I had the pleasure of having with Gino Denning, talking about Trivium. And those of you who have been listening know that we've talked about this before, and we've talked with Gene before. We've had many conversations about the Trivium, specifically the different aspects of the Trivium, which are grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and then we moved into the Quadrivium. The last time I spoke with Gene, we started talking about logic. We're going to go ahead and continue that conversation, but you'll see as you're listening that it's not specific as in taking certain steps. We are going to be talking about logic a little bit. We are going to be talking about the importance of thinking in this way. We're going to be offering a little bit more information than we offered the last time and a little bit deeper look with some examples. Now, the way that the conversation started, as it always does with Gene, because I just really enjoy speaking with him, we just went right into it. We just flowed right into it. So at the beginning of the episode, you're going to hear that it's like you're just eavesdropping on a conversation that we're already having, and we're just going to go right into it. So I'm going to start playing it from the point at which it starts to get really interesting. We began by talking about the ways in which learning about the Trivium and reading about logic and reading about the Socratic method of learning really has helped to benefit our lives in many different ways besides intellectually, and how that bleeds over into other aspects of our lives and how we have been able to apply it to not only what we're learning, but what we're doing and our interactions with people. So you're going to derive that benefit from it as well. So go ahead and listen in. I am only human.
I tell you, you know, these entheogens and psychedelics and so forth, they are mind-opening, but they also, and I can talk from personal experience, they also give you a narcissistic complex, a God complex.
Yeah, I think that I can see where that would be a slippery slope. I can recognize how that's easy to go down that road. And, you know, honestly, I think that that's just another symptom of preconditioning. And, you know, the whole divide and conquer is to work on our ego because we're egotistical beings. But I think the most important lesson that I've learned so far from studying this is to catch myself when I feel like I'm going down that road.
You have seen the true use of logical fallacies, or the most valuable use, which is to check your own thinking rather than spewing to everybody else out there what their fallacies are. I mean, that's really what rhetoric is about. And I'll touch upon this. This is really another aspect of the art of rhetoric. You in your own mind can see the fallacy, but you don't just nakedly throw it out to a person and say, you're guilty of this.
Right.
End of story. You use the Socratic technique of conversation, of asking leading questions until the person comes to realize that possibly there might be an error there, or the structure of their statement might lead to an error, is really what I should say.
What I've tried doing, and not only with my kids, I mean, I try it with my kids, but my kids, like I said, are still young, but I'm trying to implement what I'm learning with them because I feel like they're smarter than I am at this point. They'll be able to pick it up more quickly than I do. So what'll happen with them is that they'll get into an argument usually with each other, and I try to use what I've learned to help them sort it out. And I'll say, well, when your brother says this, do you think perhaps he really means this and he's just not communicating it correctly? Or I'll say, you know, when you say this and you say, well, my brother's an idiot and, you know, he thinks this and he thinks I'm dumb, and I'll say, well, let's pull this apart. So I'll use that. But I've also been able to use it in conversation with my husband. And when he and I have a disagreement, I'll try to like stop and listen more than I'm talking, and then say, okay, what I heard you say was this, but do you mean this? Like, could I be mistaken? Could I, you know? So it's been a humbling exercise for me, because usually I just snap back. And that's the, you know, the way that I grew up. That was my culture, is just to fire back when I feel like I've been fired upon. And I've tried to check myself from doing that and say, okay, you're saying this, but I don't think you mean that. I think you really mean this. Let's try to sort this out. And instead of just saying, you know, you're using a logical fallacy and that's not right. Because I think that when you do that to people, then they react with hostility, because it almost sounds like you're being aggressive toward them and you're accusing them of being stupid. And nobody likes to be told that they're being stupid. You know, so it's almost like you have to kind of check yourself and say, okay, I hear you saying this, but perhaps do you mean this?
Yeah, in a calm, reasonable fashion. I want to congratulate you by what you said about your children, because the purpose of education is to change an empty mind into an open mind. And an open mind listens as well as speaks. When you're trying to present your argument, they are not listening to you. They are hearing you say something, but they're already going through their file catalog of rebuttals. Before you even finish your statement, they already have the rebuttal in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a closed mind. They're not listening to what you say. They're listening to the content, but they're already connecting to a rebuttal. And that's what all of us do. You know, with a closed mind, we have our position, and it's going to disturb our self-esteem if we are not shown to be correct. And once you do achieve this certain level of open-mindedness, your ego, your self-esteem is not under attack when you can honestly say, I don't know, tell me more, you know.
You know, there was a time too where I guess because I felt like I was the parent, I'm supposed to provide all the answers. And as my kids get older, that's more difficult for me to do. But instead of feeling that obligation or that sense of I'm supposed to do this, I'm supposed to have all the answers, it's been easier for me to say, you know what, I don't know. Let's find the answers together. And I think that's one of the things I like most about home educating is that we can learn something together. We were reading recently about Buddhism. Well, we were reading about India, actually. It started with a history about India and the caste system. And then in learning about that, we were learning about the Buddha. And so we read about how the whole idea of Buddhism got started. And I was asking my kids what they thought about it. And the boys had a little bit less to say. So my daughter, she had this like look on her face, like a sour look. And she said, yeah, I don't, it just sounds like another religion to me. And I said, well, some people say it is. Some people say it's more of a philosophy because there are no gods. There's a person, but he, you know, myth has it that he had some special ability and he was a special person. So she said, yeah, well, even if he was, it sounds like that all his searching was based on fear. And I said, how so? So she said, well, it seems to me, according to the story, that he was never exposed to death or suffering. And when he was finally exposed to it, it terrified him. So he went in pursuit of an answer to why people have to suffer, because he was terrified of it. It just seems like if he would have just accepted that this is part of life, it would have been much better off for him. So I said, well, yeah, I was so impressed with that. I thought that was so insightful for a 10-year-old. So we started talking about it a little bit more. And then she said, well, wait a minute. Didn't India have the caste system? And I said, yeah, they did. So she said, well, if he became this great leader in India and everybody started practicing Buddhism, why did they still have the caste system? And I said, we're going to have to keep reading until we figure that out.
Wasn't that liberating?
Yeah, it actually was, because my first impulse was to say, well, you see, this is what's happening. But then as I started talking, I'm saying to myself, Lorette, you're making this up. You really don't know. So just say you don't know. And I told her that, and she accepted that. She doesn't, it's okay with her if I don't have all the answers, you know. And I said, let's keep reading. I said, because we're reading Story of the World by Susan Wise Bauer. I said, and something tells me that that'll get covered. So.
Well, I was just going to ask if that's where you were getting your info, the story.
Yeah.
And I haven't read the her four volumes, but she took that from, I'm sure she was inspired by the 11-volume set by Will and Ariel Durant called The Story of Civilization. And it was published from 1935 through the 1950s. And I've only read the very first volume, which is Our Oriental Heritage. And I was going to recommend it to you because I know that you're a big fan of nature and the natural way. Mm-hmm. And there's another side to the natural way of living. And if you read that very first volume, it shows the brutality in nature and the brutality of one step up from the tribal or the aboriginal way of living, which is barbarism. And all it does is just focus more and more on the cruel nature that each of us has within us. And we've been trying to domesticate ourselves. And the point is, we can domesticate ourselves one person at a time. This idea of factory domestication just stunts our growth. But if you read that volume, and as I say, it's the only one that I've read, it gives you the idea of where Buddha came from and what his ideas were. That, for one thing, it was just so well inculcated into Indian teachings that reincarnation is a fact. Mm-hmm. That was one thing he never questioned.
Right.
Now, he said it, looking to a personal God is a waste of time because it's invisible. We can't know that.
Mm-hmm.
So let's not waste our time on that. Let's spend our time on something which is fruitful, which is to enlighten ourselves.
Right.
To look at the visible world and puzzle out what's in there. And I don't think it was so much he who made a dogma out of what he was teaching, but the people who came after him.
Yeah, and I explained that to her, but I also explained that was just my take on it because I've just been exposed to the idea of Buddhism for longer than she has.
Yeah.
So I said, I think ultimately he did come to that conclusion that we can just accept who we are and what we are and not waste our time on other things. I said, but the more we learn, the more that'll become evident to you, and we'll go ahead and investigate that more. The question that I want to go back to, you just mentioned when you recommended the book to me, you mentioned how we've been trying to domesticate ourselves and it needs to happen one person at a time. And this whole idea of factory domestication isn't working. Do you think that has been going on over the last couple of centuries? Like, we've been trying to mass domesticate humanity and ourselves, and this has become like a problem for us.
Well, I think, and especially if you take a long-term view of history, as Susan Bauer has with her Story of the World, or it was popular at the beginning of the 20th century for several writers to take this long view. H.G. Wells came up with a two-volume set called The Outline of History. And it was pretty long and dense, and later on they came up with a digest. The story of civilization was begun in the late 1920s by Will Durant, and he married one of his students, Ariel, and she contributed to the last six or seven volumes, I think. But his work on the very first volume, Our Oriental Heritage, is his own work. But it really takes you back to the beginning, gets you to understand what the natural way of living for humans was, our simian existence, essentially. And then when we started to become more and more aware of ourselves, how we transitioned, and then how all this started up in the Orient, in China and India. He doesn't do things necessarily chronologically, because he essentially establishes a disclaimer at the very beginning saying that by necessity, because we don't know a lot of the timeline, I'm not going to follow a timeline, I'm just going to follow the ideas. So I think he starts in in Egypt, possibly Babylon, I can't recall. But when he gets to India, he does start to indicate what the caste system is, which is essentially trade guilds. The higher of the trades, the Brahmin, were the teachers, the judges, and I think the bankers, I'm not too sure. But the next supposedly second caste were the Kshatriyas, or you might call them the Kshatriyas, because the word starts with a K, and I'm not too sure that it's that the K is silent or if it's sounded, and I think it depends on the dialect that's spoken. But at any rate, they were the royalty and the warriors, and according to Will Durant, they were probably the first ones to start this idea of a caste system, because they were using physical force, and they were trying to force everybody into their way of thinking. So in what we might start to call high civilization, you can trace this idea that a small group of people wants to force everyone else into their way of thinking. So John Taylor Gatto takes up this idea of the Prussian education system a couple of hundred years ago. But you can take it back to this idea of the caste system being started either by the Kshatriyas and then the clever people, the Brahmin, using superstition to subjugate the brute force of the warrior caste. And then they became the group of people that were trying to get everyone else to follow their way of thinking. So this has a long history. It's not just a couple of hundred years ago.
The idea of forced domestication is just about equivalent to forced indoctrination. But I'm wondering now, since it is so steeped in history, is it just an unfortunate aspect of human nature that some people, as much as we long to be free and as much as deep in our soul, every human being wants to be free, is it also human nature to succumb to that part of our ego and want to force others into our way, which, of course, is self-contradictory to freedom in and of itself? But is that just a basic human flaw, do you think?
Well, another writer that I'd like to cite is Buckminster Fuller. The last book he wrote is called Critical Path, and it's a fairly short volume. He has a lot of big ideas in there, and it's essentially following the very verbose ideas that come from H.G. Wells' work and from the Durant's work. But he essentially says that this is a fact in human nature, that we are self-centered, that this is part of our defense system. The idea of education, of coming out of that box thinking of when we are attacked, we must counterattack. Or then you come to the idea that before we're attacked, we'll attack. And of course, that's the foreign policy of the United States now, which was taken over from Britain and who knows how many other places. Spain, back in the time of the discovery of the New World, they brought all the riches back that weren't pirated by the British and the Dutch off of their ships, went back to Spain, did not spend that money, that wealth, in advancing its own country. They got involved in foreign wars. So war is really one of those things that has taken on a life of its own and has had a life of its own for quite a while. And I don't think that that's a part of an individual's self-preservation instinct or what Buckminster Fuller called our self-centeredness. And I think I wrote you prior to our starting this discussion that I've really come to quite an insight over the last couple or 3 months as to the tremendous difference of presenting this material, this classical Trivium Quadrivium, the seven liberal arts, to children at the proper time as opposed to adults. Mm-hmm. Because adults already have preconceived notions.
Right.
And they're trying to fit these ideas in with their preconceived notions. And they go about it in the manner in which they have already learned. They're already in the active stage of life. And let me just interject real quickly here. I was given this idea by my mentor, and just pass it on to your children. I've mentioned it several times before, but I'm seeing its value again at my stage in life. I'm 66 years old right now as we're recording this. But I was told that there is a time for preparation of life for children, mammalian children.
Right.
Human mammals. and it's from about the time of birth to puberty, 11 or 12. This is actually the pre-preparation of learning how to learn. Then you learn how to learn from approximately 12 to as late as age 21. Then you start your active portion of life. And this is when your focus is really on today, on what you're doing today, on your family, on your livelihood, whatever that may be. I don't want to call it a career, because career is more connotative of the corporate factory model. So your livelihood and your family. And then when you reach age about 55 or 56, this is what the psychologist Carl Jung called our going into the anima and animus. And it's really when there's another physical change, when the testosterone in males starts to decrease and the estrogen in females start to decrease. Well, we each have the other's hormone. Females have a portion of testosterone and males have a portion of estrogen. And what starts to become more prevalent is males become quieter, more tame. Females become more dominant. And it's the testosterone coming through. But in both cases, the sexual urge starts to decrease. So your thoughts now, rather than being almost constantly focused on sexuality, starts to review your life in a more objective fashion.
That was mentioned in a book,
Napoleon Hill?
Think and Grow Rich.
Yeah, Napoleon
Hill. The book was Think and Grow Rich, and he talked about how at a certain age, a man is able to focus more on what his purpose is in life and what his what drives him in life, and focus more intellectually because he's not thinking about sex all the time. Mm-hmm. And before that, it's very natural to be thinking about sex because that is a human instinct to reproduce.
Sure.
And then once he gets to a certain age and the hormone starts to decrease, his mind can go elsewhere. And that's why we see a lot of great men in history become great after the age of 40 or 45. Because it actually has to do with the physical change in hormones. So while you're talking about this, that's what I'm thinking of, is that it's kind of just a normal cycle of nature.
It is. And it is chemical. It is hormonal. That change from childhood to adolescence is a hormonal change. But it affects your thinking. It mm-hmm. affects your brain chemistry as well. And this is what I liked about your last interview with Susan Weisbauer. You brought up the term coercion, and she said, well, you need to coerce children mm-hmm. at times. That doesn't mean that you have to imply that you know everything, but certain of their behaviors, actions, thoughts need guidance. At puberty, they start to become more dialectic. They start a conversation, start asking questions in a question and answer form internally. This is where the factory model that John Gatto relates to tries to shut us down. At that point, when we're going from the didactic way of looking at things, we look out to the world to get information, or to other people, or to authorities like parents, to get information. At puberty, we're now starting to find our own autonomy. And this is where the Prussian education system really starts to hamper that ability. Now, going back to India and some of the thoughts that Buckminster Fuller had, he said that there were times in ancient India when newborns of lower castes or people who were not of a caste were actually taken by the higher castes and malnourished right after birth, so that they would destroy a lot of the functionality of the brain so that they would grow up to essentially be automatons. So you can see that we've had this situation and problem, and the idea of keeping certain of us down to base levels throughout history.
Right. And those that would do it seem to understand the natural evolution of a human being and the natural maturity of a human being, and seem to understand also the principles of trivium thinking and trivium philosophy, and they're actually using it against those who don't.
Yes. And that is the problem of existence, is that things can be used for advantage or disadvantage. And that's why I'm saying that people, each individual, has to claim his own humanity. You're not entitled to it. You may want to believe that you're entitled to it, but just like no one can eat for you, no one can have sex for you, no one can sleep for you, no one can learn for you. You have to take this on yourself. Now, once you've reached adulthood, especially after going through our factory system of schooling, it's difficult to go back and look at these very abstract ideas and make sense of it. Whereas I found when you present this to a child, they just take it in.
Right.
And I've mentioned this before, they just take it in just like they take their arithmetic lesson in, or they take their history or their geography lesson in.
They accept it for what it is, and they don't try to translate it into what they already know.
Right. Now, in our last session, let me just finish my thoughts on the four stages of life. Preparing to learn how to learn. Adolescence, learning how to learn. Age 21 to 55, application of learning and continued learning. And then 55 on to death is review. And when you go from childhood to adolescence, in childhood, you absorb a lot of data. You don't necessarily have a deep understanding of it. There is comprehension, and the comprehension varies between individual children. When you get to adolescence, if you're allowed to have the dialectic process manifest within your brain, within your thoughts, then you can take the data that you absorbed as a child and start to understand it, take the contradictions out of it, and continue to learn. That doesn't mean that childhood is the place where you gather data.
Mm-hmm.
That is where you properly concentrate on gathering data, or where you absorb. It doesn't have to be forced upon you. And then in adolescence, you start bringing meaning to that and continue to gather data. But now you're adding understanding to it. And then finally, when you reach adulthood, you put those lessons into practice. But you continue to learn, and you continue to apply the methods of understanding, and of course the uses of it, and the communication to others of that. So it's each process has a starting point, but it continues through life. And if the trivium method of thinking actually becomes your default method of thinking, when it starts running in the background, where you're not even thinking about it, this process actually accelerates as you go through life, because you have changed an empty mind into an open mind. And so you can absorb ever more data, make sense of ever more data, because your brain is actually making these connections as you go through life, and it continues to become a more complex structure. It's by having this idea that this is the path of life given to children and adolescents that really helps them as they're going through life. It's not that you think about it daily. I mean, I've gone decades without thinking about it. I was given this idea when I was 13 or 14. And it didn't, it just sat there in consciousness or subconscious.
Well, I think there's that's what's so important about being able to talk to parents about this right now, so that they can begin with their children in this way. And it's almost necessary to change our mind, because we've already been indoctrinated and programmed. So we have to change our mind. We have to kind of almost erase ourselves and start with a blank slate and kind of catch ourselves when we find that we're trying to make it fit into something that we already know. We have to really make a conscious effort to do that. But the difference is that children don't have to make a conscious effort to do that.
That is exactly it.
And it's so much easier for them also because this is, it's just nature. It's just naturally how the brain operates. And like you said, it's very chemical. It's very hormonal. It's how they're going to mature anyway. Once you put them through the system and you put them through an indoctrination system, whether it be schooling or maybe you're doing some kind of inadvertent or unwitting indoctrination at home and you don't even know you're doing it because of your own programming, that's when things start to get muddy. And that's when coercion, the word coercion, feels like force. And I think Dr. Bauer said something very important when she made the distinction that coercion does not necessarily indicate violence.
Right.
That we have to separate the idea of violence from the word coercion. And that's when it starts to seem like force is when you're trying to do something against who they naturally are. But because human beings are naturally growing in this way, it's so much easier for them. And I like what you said also, that there is a starting point for each phase, just like there's a starting point for life. And it's the metaphor for me is just living. We do have a starting point for each phase in our lives, but we don't finish the other phase before we move into the next one. We're adding.
Yep.
We're not ending one and beginning another. We're just adding as we grow. We're adding more to it. So it's not that we ever stop. Because in the first process, in the first period, is that which is we call the grammar stage. It's about absorbing and it's about getting all the information and gathering the information. We don't actually stop doing that when we move into the understanding phase. We are still gathering information, but now we're adding understanding to it. And then we don't stop doing either of those two when we move into the rhetoric phase. We're just adding another ability to what we already have. So it's just how life normally is. We go from the infant stage where we're just completely dependent. And when we go to the toddler stage and we learn how to walk and talk and eat, we're not dropping our humanity, we're just adding more to it. And then we go to the next stage where we're learning how to communicate. And, the idea is that we're not actually ending. And that pretty much sums up all these stages as we move through. And that's why it's so important to begin with children, because they, like you said, it'll just always operate in the back of their consciousness and it won't be an effort. Where for me, I find that it's still somewhat of an effort. And it's becoming easier and easier because the more you implement it, the easier it becomes. And it's almost making my life easier. And I just want to interject that a little bit, because learning how to think more clearly is liberating my mind, and liberating my mind liberates my spirit and liberates me physically. So I have found great benefit. And to those that sometimes they hear this, and you know this also, Gene, they hear about Trivium, they hear about logic, and they automatically feel a little bit tensed up and they feel like, oh, difficult, hard, I don't want to do this. But I can say from firsthand experience that the more I've studied this and the more I understand it, the easier my life has actually become. And it's become less complicated because things just make a little bit more sense. And when you have clarity, life is easier.
Well, let's look at that word clarity, because what that implies is that you now don't have clutter
right.
in your head. That's why it becomes easier. It becomes more fun, because everything you're starting to focus on has meaning within your life situation. Now, you made mention that we have starting points. You also made mention that there's a point with your children as they mature that you find that you have to, I don't know that you've come to this realization yet, but you have to change your relationship with your children. It has to grow also.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you have to put your learning and understanding to work with your relationship with your children.
Absolutely. That's ongoing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And my oldest now is entering the early stages of puberty. So that's changing our relationship almost automatically. And I feel that the best thing I can do is go with the flow and not try to force the relationship, but kind of just go with the natural flow of how the relationship is changing and focus on making it a positive transition.
There were a number of people who had gotten into homeschooling within the last 20, 25 years. And of course, Susan Bauer was in the vanguard of that before it became popular to homeschool. And I think she's having, if you ask her, a fairly easy time learning and relating to her children as she goes along. There's another writer, I don't know if you're familiar with Lee Borden's and her book, or her initial book called The Core.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, you've discussed homeschooling and unschooling and these various approaches. And she has come up with what she calls home-centered education. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that concept?
Yes. As a matter of fact, Gina, who also works with Unplugged Mom, she does a lot of reviews for Unplugged Mom. She reviewed The Core in one of our articles. She was very, very pleased with that material, and I started to become familiar with it after Gina introduced me to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people compare or contrast her work with Susan Bauer's, and they're following essentially the same path. What I like about the home-centered education is I think I can speak personally very highly of that because I attended public school through all 12 grades, and I was given essentially the trivium on the side. And this can be learned or implemented by parents at home and make the home the center for trivium education. Then you can send them off. I know that schools have become babysitting services essentially,
right,
because both parents are working and so on and so forth. But because the trivium makes sense, it makes sense to children when you're giving them the grammar of things. And then if you can intercept the idea that the logic stage is beginning and that you have this internal conversation, and now you start to have a conversation with your child in more or less the round table fashion that we were speaking of in our last session in seminar, that you have the give and take. This is essentially the Socratic method. And that your child now has viewpoints and you begin to learn from your child from her viewpoint, as you just mentioned, about your 10-year-old. That was a very insightful thing that she said about Buddha, that it was, mm-hmm, that it was fear-based. I mean, she really went to the core of the thing. And that doesn't mean that fear is necessarily disadvantageous. Fear is there to get our attention.
Well, that's also a natural instinct.
Yes.
I think every living thing besides plants have an instinct for fear.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, sometimes it does get the better of us as human beings. And also I'm not necessarily saying that she was right or wrong in her thoughts, but the point wasn't whether she was right or wrong. The point was that she was thinking.
Yeah, she came up with that very abstract thought.
Right. She didn't just accept what I told her. So that's what tells me also that she's entering into the next phase, at just the beginning levels of the next phase, because she's looking for contradictions now. Moving along just a little bit, if for the interest of time, we talked about what the stages are and why they're important. And I also mentioned how sometimes when parents are first introduced to this, as much as they might say, okay, yeah, I know this is a good idea, they feel intimidated because it seems complicated. I can say firsthand that it's not nearly as complicated as it may seem at first. And once you break through that door and you start really learning and you start applying what you've learned, it's almost like the learning starts happening more automatically. But because you are an adult, you are able to add the understanding and you are able to add the rhetoric to it. But you have to do it at your own pace. You can't rush and you have to allow it to happen. The only thing that I found that I have to catch myself is I will try to translate it to what I've already been conditioned to believe. But if I'm able to catch myself, then I can do that. One of the best ways to introduce an adult to the trivium way of thinking is through logical fallacies. And I think that that's a good way to introduce it because it's something that we can sort of apply to our lives right away. When we start to recognize the fallacies, we start to see what was previously unseen. And it almost becomes exciting because we understand people so much better. We understand our spouse so much better when we're in an argument. We understand our friends so much better when they contradict what we're saying. And it just starts to make sense and you start to declutter, like you said, and things start to go into their place in your mind. And it's almost like when you clean up your office space or your bedroom and everything's all over the place. But once you organize it, everything looks so clean and wonderful that you can't wait to do more, you know?
All you have to do is look into 20 to 60 of the fallacies. A lot of people don't know that they exist. And this is work that's been done by various thinkers for thousands of years, you know, coming up with these very common fallacies. In fact, fallacies are the fourth branch of the study of Aristotelian logic. And I want to make the distinction between Aristotelian classical logic or propositional logic and other types of logic that have terms that are thrown in there, particularly symbolic logic. If you want to study symbolic logic and computer logic and all these other things that are really more akin to syntax, do so after you have internalized Aristotelian logic, the four branches of Aristotelian logic: deductive thinking, taking things apart; inductive thinking, putting things together and generalizing; and word or term definition by genus and differentia. And all I've mentioned there are the very basics of what need to be internalized. And once you make a detailed study of these things, these are the points that will stick out in your mind. And finally, the logical fallacies were devised by various thinkers, as I say, over the years, using those first three branches of logic. But many people, as I say, don't even know that there's such a thing as these common logical fallacies. And when they do learn about it, you would hope, especially if they have families, they have children, so now they have a motivation to look into how these fallacies were discovered, because they really are discoveries. And you can go out into the world and live life as it is today, at this time, in this place, and see where there is error around you, and decide through deeper understanding by going back and studying other aspects of logic and grammar if you want to participate or not. It gives you, as you say, that clarity, and clarity brings good decisions. Good decisions lead to good personal action.
I just want to make the distinction that, and this is something I've had to learn as well, and I think we all do, and I hope that we can all embrace this. Once you start to learn what logical fallacies are, and then learn how to recognize when they're being used, the idea is not to point the finger at people and tell them that they're being fallacious. The idea is to kind of internally understand, okay, this person isn't communicating correctly, there's fallacy here, and then use it in your dialogue with them, but not necessarily to start slinging arrows at them and tell them that they're being flawed, because all that's going to do is make more of a mess. What you want to do is be able to improve your communication with other people by recognizing that there may be a flaw in their thinking, and then use that to try to come to some kind of agreement with them, knowing that they're not communicating as well as they hope to be.
Well, that is the art of rhetoric, the final stage of the trivium. We had discussed that previously, that rhetoric is this discussion, this method of intelligently communicating with other people. But what I have found the logical fallacies of most value is in checking my own thinking.
Yes. Yes, I can attest to that as well.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Now, when someone or another party uses a logical fallacy, what is your reaction to that? You've got to take a little time to step back. This is really what the trivium helps you to do, is just to take a little step back and look at a bigger picture. Because your reaction to a fallacy can often be a fallacy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That has happened with me quite often, where I'll respond to it, and my ego speaks first.
Right.
That's how I've been, you know, programmed.
Sure.
I react to it, and I won't point it out necessarily, but I react to it, and inside I feel so smart, you know, and I'm reacting to it, and then no sooner is it out of my mouth that I say, "Oh, That probably wasn't the best thing either. So I've learned to take a step back and kind of think about it for a minute. And also, Gene, what I have found also, and this is in communicating with my children, with my friends, with my spouse, especially in a disagreement with my spouse, I will realize that I may have started it inadvertently by using some kind of false dichotomy or some kind of ad hominem or whatever, and I didn't realize it, and then they responded to me and an argument ensued. And if I think about it a little while, I often can see that I started it without realizing it because I was using some kind of fallacy and yes. I was introducing that into the conversation. So it's almost like I have to go back to that and say, wait a minute, I know where this started. You're saying that because I said this, but I didn't say that correctly. Let's start again. And it's so helpful.
Again, the art of rhetoric. This is where the value of discussion comes in. Discussion is a learning process. If you take your empty mind and educate it to be open, you can start to take these greater, larger aspects, the bigger picture in, and discuss it. Everyone has something to teach you. There may be very negative situations that people come, have developed a connotation, like a lot of people have a connotation about atheism, that atheism is evil and of no use at all. Yet you can learn a lot from the ideas that are espoused within atheism. And in the other direction, a lot of people take religion as being almost without merit. And yet that is what our ancestry is. This has been developed to a very high degree. And if you look beneath the surface, if you take the larger picture of it all, you can see how atheism has reacted, is a knee-jerk reaction to a lot of mythology, a lot of poetry that's in there that can communicate subtle things that have been known by people, our ancestors before us, and which we can come to know as well. And then implement the ideas within philosophy, which is looking at the thing itself, and finally science. Mm-hmm. So there's the whole picture right there. Mythological poetry, philosophy, and the scientific method. And that's where we have developed to this point. Now, it may be a grandiose thought, but this is what I see as the next stage in human development. When enough children come to the point where they have an open mind, a critical amount of their neurology is developed so that they can continue to learn and understand through adulthood, we will have come out completely from our barbarous state where we have to reform the thoughts of others. No one needs reformation of thought like the other guy.
Right.
But when we can all learn from one another in this spirit of learning, I think that's the next stage in beyond self-awareness, which is unity awareness of ourselves and our situation within our surroundings or the universe. And it's going to be augmented, of course, by technology and so on and so forth. I don't know that it's even going to happen, but I can actually see the possibility of this happening. And it will happen with people who don't find learning and application of advantageous learning to be difficult. Those people who can actually utilize knowledge and understanding of the real world in the real world.
I said a couple of shows ago that we should all home educate to save the world. And I'm thinking the same thing right now because I feel like if in order to really help children grow in this way, keeping them out of school is helpful because like you said, if they need to be in school, you can certainly supplement at home in the way that you learned. Clearly, it was successful for you, but it is easier if we don't have to combat what is happening to them in school. And when you went to school, it was probably very different than how school is now. I think it's gotten worse. It's gotten more indoctrinated and more totalitarian. So if we can keep them away from that environment, we might have greater success in allowing them to develop this thinking ability. And I'm going to go back to that again and say, hey, you know, we'll save the world if we can eliminate school.
Well, school as it is, probably, yeah.
Yeah, school as it is, of course, school as it is. Because learning is always okay, and I'm okay with community learning, just not in the way that it's happening right now.
Yeah. Take the historical perspective. Look at Susan Bauer's Story of the World, the story of civilization, the outline of history, and you can see that these really are cyclical in nature, that they just happen over and over again. I keep going back. I tell everybody that I'm reading tomorrow's headlines today by opening up Edward Gibbon's The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, you can just open that thing up randomly to any page, and there is our world today. There is the United States today.
Yep. And you know, it's amazing, isn't it? It's a little bit creepy and a little bit funny at the same time.
It really is.
Well, just to reiterate, to round off what you were just explaining, I'm thinking that perhaps a simpler way to put it is, if we could embrace the idea of not asking ourselves constantly, what can I teach this person? What can I show this person? How can I show off? If we can change that to, what can I learn from you? What can I learn from this situation? Then maybe it could help change our perspective a little bit.
Well, again, there are beginnings to everything. So I think you have to begin, if you are the type of person that wants to project your ego. You can begin by using that, but ultimately, what you want to do is to get into conversation, to get into relationships with people where you are both looking for truth. You can bring something to the table. You can learn something from that other person. And at some point, you will have realized the truth. You will have done away with all the superfluous clutter and brought clarity to the situation. So if you can find the truth seekers, and of course that is another age-old situation. We were mentioning Siddhartha Gautama earlier, the Buddha, and that's what he was trying to do, was get a group of people who wanted to become awake. And he found at his point in time that there weren't that many people that wanted to become awake.
Right.
And of course he was dealing with adults. Our friend Jarrett Sanchez has looked into Freemasonry quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And in many circles, that particular school of thought is disparaged. He led me to some ideas about a person who has published a number of works, and I've gotten his works, and I've found that this is essentially what I was being taught as an adolescent. And there's much to be found in there. Now, there's a lot that I don't agree with, but that doesn't mean that I can't take the wisdom that's in there and use and appreciate and not necessarily disparage what I don't understand.
Well, maybe the base idea and the base philosophy in thinking, because from what I understand is very similar to trivium thinking anyway.
It is.
Is very, very valuable, but perhaps some of their implementation is disagreeable, and that's okay. Take from it the value in the lesson. And, you know, it's always better to understand what the others are doing anyway, so that you can better communicate and better, you know, get through your life and understand where they're coming from. So there is value in everything. And I think we automatically put up walls when we hear it because of the implications that we've been taught.
Well, one of the things that I've come out of through studying some of these publications is that most people that become interested in Masonic work for the first time are adults.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to understand this idea that I was mentioning earlier that was brought forth by Buckminster Fuller, that we are self-centered, that once we become adults, we are self-centered. And they actually use the term trivium and quadrivium as the method for learning how to learn.
Right.
And the first three degrees, I guess, here in this country, I think it's called Blue Lodge Masonry, which maybe have started in England. I'm not too sure about the history. I mean, it is an organization with secrets, after all. So
right, right.
But But they actually take this into account and leave you to your own devices, that there are some people who are going to have, at the point that they become interested in Masonry, a more open mind. They already have an implementation of education, and others won't. Well, they still allow them to go through the motions, but not necessarily, as they say, do the work, which is to come to this idea of learning how to learn. So by the time you get through the first three degrees in American Masonry, if it's done properly, you are at that point where you have prepared to learn how to learn, just as a child prepares. You have come to this point of learning how to learn, which I believe is the second degree. And finally, you're a master where you can apply it. And those are the first three degrees of Masonry. And as I say, one of the things that they do is they use separation a lot. They use, and John Gatto addressed this, they use prestige,
mm-hmm.
personal prestige. And they use that as a motivation, because now you have separated yourself to become a master.
Right.
And so now you're the A student, and you've separated yourself from the B student and the C student. Now, this can be detrimental at some point, where we start separating ourselves, and this is what we call elitism.
It creates division.
Now, at some point, you're going to get stuck in elitism, where you don't go any further than, I'm the greatest.
Right.
You know, and my brothers here, we're all the greatest.
It plays on our ego.
But, as was used in a couple of other examples, if you can see through that, you can continue with your personal development. And then, as we each develop individually, as I just mentioned earlier, if we can get children to take this approach. See, we can teach children the trivium and quadrivium without their having to resort to personal prestige.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's introduced in factory schools, this idea of ABCD.
Right.
Now,
and that's what plays on the ego and what creates division.
Sure, creates division. Now, it's a test, according to this particular author. If you can pass the test, you will have gone beyond that. You will see that it's not about prestige. And now you are worthy. And unfortunately, you know, this is one of the things that I have to come to an understanding about, who is worthy and who is unworthy. The one thing they do is they hand out the trivium and quadrivium to people. And I think that this is the way to save the world, as you say, to just hand out the trivium and quadrivium at the proper point in development of people, which is before they reach adulthood, where they go down to the local Masonic Hall. But give them grammar in their childhood and the other two points of the trivium in their adolescence, and of course introduce the quadrivium as well, the idea of using the symbol of number rather than the symbol of letter to communicate ideas. So this is all well-known stuff. It's hidden in plain sight. It really is.
Well, that is the best way to fool people, is by hiding things in plain sight. But the good news is that we're folks like you and so many others out there are beginning to find those little hints that are hidden in plain sight and make sense of them, because it goes back to the fact that although we are inherently flawed as human beings, we do inherently want to be free and we want to be peaceful. We don't want to be constantly at odds. And perhaps that is what is driving us to move forward and finally evolve. And I do really believe that human progression is not through a rejection of formal education, but through an embracing of a classical education so that we can liberate our mind. I don't think freedom is found in rejecting it. I think freedom is found in embracing the liberation that is found through knowing and through understanding. And I think about Albert Einstein quote, where he said that any fool, and I might be misquoting, but any fool can know something, but the idea is to understand what we know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole idea in this philosophy, and we can trace this philosophy back to ancient Greece.
Well, they gave it to us in the West. This was already well-established in the Orient. And in fact, as far as the antiquity is concerned, I've been very fortunate in the last 3 years to have corresponded with a number of people who are interested in this. And just recently, a gentleman who, believe it or not, is a hunter, is a tracker in the northwestern part of the U.S., but he put me onto a book that was written by a South African gentleman that was supposedly coming back into publication. But he correlated the trivium with tracking, that this is actually where the writer, this South African writer, whose name doesn't come to mind at the moment, actually traces science, technology, back to tracking. And it is the trivium exactly. The human goes out there and gathers data. He is tracking possibly game to feed himself and his family or his tribe. So he goes out and looks for, let's say, deer, for a deer to bring down. So he looks for deer sign. He looks for branches broken at a certain level. He looks for scat, the droppings of the deer, and he follows that. And then he starts to see a pattern as to where this deer is going. So he knows that he can probably trap the deer, say, over here in this small canyon, and the deer is more likely to be brought down there. So by following the trail, he brings his understanding as to the behavior of the deer. And of course, he passes this down to his progeny, how to gather the data, then how to understand the data. And finally, the successful hunt, the bringing down of the deer, is the culmination, that is the rhetoric. And this corresponds to the three levels of the scientific method, as this gentleman traces it, which is observation of the world, hypothesis formation, which is bringing understanding, or this is a mental process. Observation is out in the real world. Then you do a mental process of hypothesizing. Then you go back to the real world to bring about a result in the real world, or experimentation. So if your hypothesis is correct, your experiment, which you have designed from your hypothesis, goes to place. So it is correct, therefore true. If it is not correct, it will not go to place, and your hypothesis is not true. Now this is trivium thinking again.
That is probably the most accurate metaphor I've heard.
Yeah.
That's perfect, because it, yeah, one deals with physical nutrition, mm-hmm, hunting down and eventually arriving at physical nutrition, whereas in this way, thinking, we're hunting after intellectual nutrition.
Yeah.
And it's the process of getting there, and it's a very natural procedure of getting there, but there is a procedure there. There is a way to follow there, but it is a very natural way if we pay attention to our instinct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Amazing. That's very accurate.
Well, I was in the same situation that you were for a long time. I thought all this originated with Aristotle in Greece. And then I started to trace, thanks to Will Durant and his first volume, I started to trace it back to the Orient. And then this is another little nugget that I was given by my mentor, this dentist that I worked with for a number of years when I was going through high school. But he said, and this is another thing that just laid dormant in the back of my mind, but he said, whatever you can find in Western literature, in ancient Western literature, whatever comes from the classical period, which is Greece and Rome, or from Egypt, or Babylonia, Mesopotamia, Persia, what was called Elam in ancient times, he says, can be stated more simply and accurately in Indian literature.
Mm-hmm.
And by golly, I have found that to be true.
We can probably trace it right back to the beginning of civilization, the beginning of humanity, if we were able to do that. I don't know that anyone's really able to do that without just speculating, but I think we can probably trace it back, because I'm convinced that it is simply the way our brain functions. And
sure,
the only reason that we today don't recognize that is because it's been programmed out of us. But I think it's been programmed out of us by those that know that this is the way that we think. In other words, to keep us stunted and to keep us from evolving.
Mm-hmm.
but we will evolve. Gene, we're almost out of time for this particular session, but I'd like to do two things. Number one, invite you back for another session because I just can't get enough.
Well, I'm actually glad that we're taking some time between our sessions because I've come to a number of insights just since the last time we did our last show together. Yeah, we can cover this a little bit more. We had discussed in our last show to bring forth some practical applications of this way of thinking. And what I found is that people don't know how to distill the trivium and quadrivium. And I think rather than going into practical applications, is I'll try to bring the essence of the sources, the essence of the information from the sources in which adults can get started. And thank goodness for people like Susan Bauer and John Gatto and Lee Bortons and the person who really got me going with it, Dorothy Sayers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of material to get youngsters started with this. And then once the parents, the adults start to embrace this idea of learning along with their children, then things can really start to get exciting, I think.
Yes, I can see that. And I am learning too that that's probably correct. We do tend to look for, okay, well, tell me how to do it. Where are the instructions? And I understand that. But what I'm finding out, and I'm agreeing with you also, is that you really can't offer instructions. That's not the idea. The idea is not to provide actual step A, step B, step C. But the idea is to get adults to really understand what the essence is. And then the practicality comes almost naturally by itself. But one thing that I would like to leave our audience with after this particular session, until we meet again, is something that they can apply in their lives immediately so that they can begin to open up their minds and truly understand just how useful this way of thinking can be. Almost like an open door, almost like giving them one key to unlock the first door on this path. I'll let you choose one of the most common that you come across, one of the most common logical fallacies that a person runs into, just for the sheer sake of being able to recognize when it's being done.
Well, you just mentioned it. I'm going to mention the most commonly applied, and that is appeal to authority. What you just said is people want the instruction, want the authority to give them, to download into them what they need to have. So just because an authority says it does not mean that it is true or accurate. If it's something that's meaningful to you and it's been said by an authority, look for the evidence on your own. The second one, which is probably the second most common fallacy, is equivocation, especially in the English language, using the same term in two different ways in the same conversation. Or let me give the term that a policeman will use when he pulls you over for a ticket. You don't realize that there's another self to you, and it's called, and this is named after another logical fallacy, a straw man. But if you look at any legal document here in the United States, your driver's license, your birth certificate.
That's your straw man.
That's your straw man.
Yeah.
It's a all capital letter reference.
Right. That's your legal entity, but it's not
right.
You. It's the legal fiction entity.
So when the policeman gives you a ticket, says that you're to appear at so-and-so or send in the funds with the tickets, he'll always end by saying, "Do you understand?" And if you reply, "I comprehend," he will, and I've done this, I've tried this, he will again just look at you and he says, "Do you understand? Do you stand under my authority or the authority that I represent?" That's what he means by understand. Now, see, you have one connotation of understand, but if you parse just the word understand, it's that which stands, the physical stature of something, and that which is under it, or the natural law underneath that which stands, that which we as humans have come to know of the thing that stands. So if you parse it like that, you can give several meanings to the word understand. And in the context the policeman is using, he is saying, once you affirm it, even though you don't have the same connotation of that denoted word, understand, you think he's asking you, do you comprehend? No, he's asking, do you accept my authority? Do you stand under my authority?
So if you respond, I comprehend, does he repeat it?
He'll just go back to say, do you understand?
That's funny.
Yeah. And he's talking to your straw man. And so there we are tying the two most common fallacies, the fallacy from authority and the fallacy from equivocation, together. If you're dealing with a policeman and you think that you know the law better than he does, here is the defensive aspect of wisdom. This was said by a modern thinker, and he says, wisdom is the quality which keeps you out of situations in which you need to use it.
Oh, that's perfect.
In other words, if you think that cop is done with you just because you don't sign it, doesn't mean that he can't come along and bring about other consequences, you see. So use your wisdom, use your questioning and your insight into the world and its workings before you decide to deal with authority on their own level.
Excellent. Excellent. And that's a great note to leave the audience on for now. And let's let this simmer and let's let this absorb. And then we'll come back perhaps in a few weeks and we'll do another session on understanding the essence of the stages, grammar, logic, and
right.
And rhetoric, and so on. Very good. Excellent. Well, thank you so much again for joining us, Gene. I'm really happy to have you back, and I'm glad that we were able to connect again. And I look forward, as usual, to our next encounter.
I do, too. Thank you.
All right, everyone. That's it. That was Gene O'Denning on Unplugged Mom Radio. For more information, visit unpluggedmom.com. And I am your host, Laurette Lynn, saying bye-bye.